You are listening to a download from the Fraser Institute. This is a recording of a speech delivered on May 3rd in Vancouver by Anne Kruger, Deputy Managing Director of the International Monetary Fund. Her topic was the New Economic Century, Experience and Opportunity in the Reform Process.
My name is Mark Mullins. I'm the Executive Director of the Fraser Institute, and I want to welcome you all today. We have a very interesting discussion ahead of us with Anne Kruger at the IMF. I want to as well thank Canaccord Capital for their generous support as a sponsor of this meeting. It's my honor today to introduce our guest speaker, Dr. Anne Kruger. She's going to be presenting the 21st annual Dr. Harold Walter Siebens Lecture. Anne Kruger has been first Deputy Managing Director of the IMF since September 1st, 2001. Before coming to the fund, Ms. Kruger was the Harold L. and Carolyn L. Rich Professor in Humanities and Sciences in the Department of Economics at Stanford University. She was also the founding director of Stanford Center for Research on Economic Development and Policy Reform and a senior fellow of the Hoover Institution. Dr. Kruger had previously taught at the University of Minnesota and Duke University, and from 1982 to 1986 was the World Bank's Vice President for Economics and Research. She received her undergraduate degree from Oberlin College and her PhD in economics from the University of Wisconsin. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Anne Kruger.
Good afternoon. Thank you for that kind introduction. I'm very pleased to be here today and to share some thoughts with you about the world economy at the beginning of the 21st century, and in particular, to examine some of the ways in which we can use the experience of the past few decades to ensure continued growth and prosperity in the world economy and extend the benefits of that growth to all. As Canadians, you have firsthand experience of the benefits of growth. This country has experienced average annual real GDP growth of 3.4% over the past decade, making it one of the most rapidly growing industrial countries. Per capita income has also outpaced the other big economies, growing at an average of 2.4% a year. Unemployment is at a 30-year low, and inflation has been contained. Canada has demonstrated that sound monetary policy and fiscal prudence, including a reduction in government debt, can provide a solid foundation for rapid growth over a prolonged period of time. Of course, the benefits of Canada's sound economic policy framework have been considerably enhanced by the strong performance of the world economy as a whole in recent years. 2006 is likely to be the fourth successive year in which real GDP growth has grown by more than 4% globally. Indeed, the IMF's own forecasts, which were just released a couple of weeks ago, predict global growth of almost 5% this year, and that's the second upward revision that we've made on those forecasts. Published last September, were lower, and 5% is truly phenomenal. And we're talking about worldwide growth. Every region of the world has been expanding in recent years. The pace has been set by China, India, and the rest of emerging Asia, of course, but we're also seeing rapid growth in Latin America, the Middle East, and Africa. And among the industrial countries, growth both here in Canada and in the United States remains rapid. Japan appears to be making a strong recovery, and there are signs of an upturn in those parts of Western Europe, including Germany and France, where growth has been pretty sluggish. The currently buoyant outlook for the world economy is all the more remarkable given continuing geopolitical uncertainty and the sharp rise in oil prices we've seen, and it's true that these act as a reminder of the downside risks to the central expectations of continuing rapid growth. Global imbalances pose another risk, with a large U.S. current account deficit, large reserves building up in Asia and the oil-exporting countries, and low rates of growth in some parts of Western Europe. Unilateral action by one country or group of countries to tackle this issue could adversely affect growth prospects at the global level. Further rises in oil prices or a widespread avian flu outbreak might also result in slower global growth. Thus far, though, the world economy has proved remarkably resilient in the face of shocks. Growth has remained buoyant, and the most recent global slowdown in 2001 to 2002 was relatively mild and short-lived. This generally favorable global environment owes much to the lessons learned from the experience of the past decade and a half. Macroeconomic management has improved significantly in many industrial and in many developing countries, and this, along with other reforms, has raised the potential growth rates in many parts of the world. The current conjuncture provides us with the opportunity to press ahead with the reform process. This is vital if higher growth rates are to be sustained, and in the case of many developing countries, raised still further in order to permit large-scale reductions in poverty. Implementing further reforms will also reduce vulnerability to shocks. The larger the number of countries well-placed to cope with the next slowdown in growth, the more likely it is that the slowdown will be mild and the recovery rapid. So today what I want to do is review the lessons we've learned about the best ways of delivering macroeconomic stability and fostering more rapid growth. I'll then say something about the nature of the economic reforms that are needed. The world economy has undergone some rapid and dramatic changes in the recent past. There is perhaps no clearer manifestation of this than our own recent experience with inflation. 25 years ago, 111 of the IMF's member countries, which is close to two-thirds of our membership at the time, had double-digit rates of inflation. Last year, 35 countries had double-digit inflation, which is less than a fifth of our membership. In 1980, 39 members had inflation rates above 20%. Last year, 5 did. The global inflation rate has declined from an average annual of close to 15% in 1980 to 84 to 3.8% in 2005. The average inflation rate in the industrial economies fell from almost 9.5% in 1975-79 and almost 9% in 1980 to 2.3% in 2005, and is projected to decline further according to our latest estimates. In developing countries, the decline has been even steeper and more rapid. In the early 1990s, the average inflation rate in developing countries was around 80%. That had declined to 5.4% in 2005. The IMF forecasts currently project a further drop, getting it below 5% by 2007. This dramatic fall owes a great deal to significantly improved macroeconomic management. Monetary policy has become much more effective, helped by the spread of central bank independence and, in many cases, by inflation targeting. And as inflation has declined and more countries have adopted fiscally prudent policies, growth has become more rapid and more durable. So the benefits of lower inflation have been amply demonstrated. But other developments in the global economy in the past 15 years or so have taught us about the importance of macroeconomic stability in general and about what is needed to deliver long-term macro stability. The history of the world economy is, of course, one of change, and the history of economic policymaking is one of learning from experience. As we learn more about how economies work, we acquire a better understanding of how policy should be shaped to better foster growth and prosperity. The multilateral framework set in place at the end of World War II was and remains highly successful. And it owed much to the lessons learned in the 1930s. The beggar thy neighbor policies that raised trade barriers and favored competitive devaluations had brought the global economy to the brink of collapse. The architects of the post-war system wanted to avoid a repeat of that. They understood the close link between rapid economic growth and the rapid expansion of global world trade. They also understood that the maintenance of international financial stability was essential for the expansion of global trade. That, of course, is why the IMF was created at the Bretton Woods Conference in 1944. And the post-war architects also recognized that trade liberalization, the progressive reduction of tariff and non-tariff barriers to trade, implemented in a multilateral context, was an equally vital ingredient of this equation. As a result of the rapid post-war expansion of world trade that in turn acted as a key driver of global growth, millions of citizens around the world are far better off. At the time this new multilateral framework was being established, the world was broadly divided into three groups of countries: the small group of industrial nations, the much more numerous developing countries, and the centrally planned economies of the Soviet bloc, which were largely detached from the world economy. One of the most striking contrasts between the world economy then and now is the extent of differentiation among countries. We now have low-income countries, emerging market countries, oil producers, industrial countries, and many more. Over the past 50 years, the industrial countries have all grown rapidly, of course, but there have been and are significant differences among them in terms of GDP growth rates and rates of productivity growth. And although inflation performance has converged in recent years, there were sharp differences among the advanced countries in earlier years. But the diverging performance of developing countries has been much more pronounced even than that of the industrial countries since the 1950s. Some emerging market economies, those pursuing outward-oriented trade policies focusing on macroeconomic stability, have grown much more rapidly. Korea, for example, is now in the OECD. It is the world's 11th largest exporter. In terms of performance and per capita income levels, it has more in common with advanced economies than most developing countries. But in 1960, it was the third poorest country in Asia and one of the world's poorest countries. The same is true, to a lesser extent, of several other Asian and some Latin American countries. The result is that some of the larger developing countries are increasingly important players in the international economy, and if their high growth rates persist, they will become even more so in the years to come. China and India still have relatively low levels of per capita income, but they are the world's most populous countries and among the most rapidly growing, and their importance in the global economy has greatly increased. India's share of world exports has nearly doubled in the past 15 years, while China's share has tripled. India's share of global services exports shot up from just under 1% to more than 2.5% globally, and China's share grew by half to almost 3%. At the other extreme, though, are the low-income countries, still extremely poor, and whose relative position, in some cases absolute, has even worsened. The poor economic performance of many sub-Saharan African countries is well known. After the Second World War, sub-Saharan African countries were generally reckoned to have real per capita incomes well above those of most Asian countries other than Japan. For example, in 1956, Ghana's per capita income was estimated to be more than a third higher than that of South Korea. Yet so slowly has Ghana's per capita income grown since then that by 2003, Korea's per capita income was more than eight times that of Ghana. The plight of these low-income countries is one of the most important challenges we face. But before I say more about that and other challenges, let me outline some of the most important lessons I believe we have learned about macroeconomic management. Most of the policy reforms undertaken by industrial and developing countries in recent years reflect the lessons of experience during the 1990s. We learned a great deal, for example, from our experience with what used to be called the transition economies, the formerly communist states of the Soviet bloc. Since turning centrally planned economies into normally functioning market economies had never before been attempted, this was truly a case of learning on the job. But in spite of some temporary setbacks, most of these countries are now largely integrated into the global economy and share the same economic problems that many other countries face. But perhaps the most significant development during the 1990s was the sharp rise in private international capital flows to emerging market countries. When the post-war economic framework was established, the working assumption was that private capital flows would never resume and never recover the dominant role they had had at the end of the 19th century and had struggled to reattain in the 1920s. In fact, private flows among industrial countries had resumed on a relatively large scale by the 1960s, but it was only by the 1990s when private capital flows to developing countries eclipsed official flows. It soon became evident that these large private flows would have significant implications for macroeconomic policy and for the IMF. A series of emerging market financial crises, starting with Mexico in late 1994, were fundamentally different from the problems to which the IMF and its member countries had been accustomed. These were capital account crises, unlike the traditional balance of payments crises for which the fund had provided temporary support to countries having to undertake policy adjustments. Capital account crises had two principal features that made them different. First was the source of the crisis. A major change in the willingness of foreigners and domestic residents to hold domestic assets. Second was the speed with which these crises erupted and with which a policy response had to be prepared. After Mexico, we saw crises in some Asian countries in 1997 and 98, in Russia in 1998, and elsewhere thereafter. At first, it was assumed in some quarters that these crises reflected capricious shifts in investor sentiment, that national economies were now subject to the whims of speculators. The outflows of capital were certainly enormous. The Asian crisis countries, for example, experienced a reversal of capital flows equivalent to more than 10% of GDP in 2 years. Such shifts would cause enormous dislocation for any economy. The falls in GDP were large, sudden, and enormously adverse in their consequences for many citizens. But it became clear that painful though these crises were, they had their origins in the underlying weaknesses in the economies affected, weaknesses to which investors had reacted. In some cases, governments had accumulated debts that were unsustainable. In others, rapid private sector credit growth had led to a sharp deterioration in the quality of lending, with a rise in the number of bad loans with adverse implications for potential economic growth. Other factors often made the shift in sentiment of investors even worse. Fixed exchange rates made it difficult for governments to react quickly to the shift in capital flows. Currency mismatches were common as banks built up liabilities in one country and had assets in their domestic currency. When devaluation was forced on governments in the wake of crisis, financial institutions and businesses were left facing massive losses or insolvency. The role played by weak financial sectors, especially poor credit allocation and the currency mismatches, had particularly important consequences for macroeconomic management. The fund was heavily involved in the resolution of these crises. Financial support was often needed urgently and on a larger scale than had been the case in earlier episodes where fund support was needed. Yet in spite of the difficulties, it is clear with hindsight the adjustment programs put in place with fund support were far more successful than most observers believed possible at the time. So what did our experience in the 1990s teach us about delivering growth and prosperity? Several important lessons stand out. First and foremost is the crucial importance of a flexible exchange rate regime. Fixed exchange rates pose significant challenges because they mean fiscal and monetary policies must always be consistent with the exchange rate regime and subordinated to it. The countries affected by capital account crises were all hampered in their initial responses to trouble by fixed or heavily managed exchange rate regimes. Second lesson is the importance of a sound macroeconomic framework that can bring macroeconomic stability and sustainable growth. In a globalized world, economies must have monetary and fiscal policies that make possible falling or low inflation and foster budgetary prudence. Third is the need for sustainable levels of public sector debt. Fiscal policy has to be capable of servicing public debt. And that debt should not be so large that sharp changes in the global economy, rising global interest rates, for example, undermine the government's ability to service the debt. Debt reduction is also important in enabling governments to pursue countercyclical fiscal policies when there are downturns. Fourth is the importance of flexibility. An economy needs to be flexible to maximize its growth potential. It needs to be capable of smooth adjustment to changing circumstances to enable it to continue to grow rapidly in the face of technological change, to respond to changing competitive pressures, to respond to demographic changes, and, of course, to respond to shocks. So an economy needs to have flexible labor markets, flexible product markets, and so on. A fifth important lesson is the closeness of the link between the financial sector and economic stability and growth. And this has assumed increasing importance both in national policymaking and in the fund's work. Our experience in the 1990s, we had reinforced what we had already known, but which we did not always fully appreciate, that a weak financial sector can undermine economic growth. Resources are misallocated, average rates of return on capital fall. A well-regulated financial sector, by contrast, with proper supervisory arrangements, is essential. Without this, financial sector weakness can undermine stability and, in turn, growth. Closely related to improved financial sector performance and key to the improved governance that makes possible improved macroeconomic performance in general is the issue of transparency. We have learned that at the sectoral, the national, and the global level, the more openly individuals, firms, and institutions go about their business, and the more open they are to public scrutiny, the more effectively they will perform. The risk of corruption is much reduced, there is less opportunity to conduct transactions in secret, and more pressure to ensure that everything is above board and seen to be so. There is also less risk that narrow interests will carry undue influence when firms, institutions, or governments make decisions that affect large numbers of people. Doing things in the public gaze demonstrates that there is nothing to hide. Doing things in secret arouses suspicions, even when they aren't justified. So much progress has been made on many issues in many countries, and many of those lessons learned are already bearing fruit. But while progress on many fronts has been impressive, many challenges remain. At the global level, the most important is securing a satisfactory outcome to the Doha round of trade negotiations. The prospect of a significant lowering of barriers to agricultural and services trade and further liberalization of trade and manufacturers could provide a boost to world trade and, in turn, to world growth. A Doha agreement would greatly strengthen the world global trading system, and conversely, a failure would weaken it and give encouragement to protectionists who mistakenly believe that economies gain from erecting trade barriers against other countries. Without a Doha agreement, global growth would be slower, and the world economy would be less resilient in the face of shocks. Trade negotiations are, by their nature, nail-biting affairs, and the Doha negotiations have been unusually tense, with several deadlines already missed. Yet all those involved know how high the stakes are, and no one will want to be blamed for failure. Experience tells us that there is still time for agreement to be reached, and there are signs that those most closely involved are working hard and still trying to reach a deal. At the national level, the favorable short-term outlook is a window of opportunity that policymakers cannot afford to ignore. It is always easier to introduce reforms during periods of expansion. They can be planned carefully for maximum effectiveness. And building a consensus for reform, while always challenging, is easier during the good times. These are challenges for all countries. Among the industrial countries, there is scope to further fiscal adjustment to aim for balance over the business cycle. Economies with high budget deficits in good times have little or no room for maneuver in the more difficult times. Global growth performance may have been strong, but there is no evidence that we have abolished forever the occasional downturns. Most industrial countries are also facing the prospect of significant demographic change. As populations age very rapidly in some countries, public pension systems are coming under increasing strain. As the elderly dependency ratio rises and fewer workers support an increasing number of elderly citizens, measures will be needed to ensure that fiscal policy remains on a sustainable path. Action is needed sooner rather than later to avoid a fiscal crunch. In emerging market countries, governments need to press ahead with further fiscal reforms and with debt reductions. Many have made great strides in reducing debts, but debt levels remain uncomfortably high. Without further fiscal consolidation and debt reduction, governments will not be able to use countercyclical fiscal policies when appropriate. But fiscal reform is also important because many of these countries will also confront demographic change. It may be further off for most of these countries, but the challenges are greater. Public pension schemes, while more limited in coverage, are already expensive and unsustainably generous to those who are covered. Measures have already been taken in many emerging market economies to bring down debt-to-GDP ratios, to reduce foreign currency exposure, and to lengthen debt maturities. But there's still more to be done. Debt levels remain uncomfortably high in many of them, making them more vulnerable than is desirable to changes in global interest rates or the liquidity environment or to currency fluctuations. The currently favorable environment also provides an important opportunity for governments, especially in developing countries, to press on with the structural reforms that will further enhance the flexibility of their economies and increase their growth potential. Many economies have labor market rigidities that hamper growth prospects. Many have burdensome business regulations and weak enforcement of contracts and property rights that discourage enterprise and so undermine growth and, in turn, poverty reduction. Let me say just a little more about this. A useful and very revealing publication by the World Bank, called Doing Business, and there's one every year, and I commend it to you. But the one I'm going to cite from is Doing Business 2006. It illustrates the scope for improvement in many cases. Take labor market regulation. The economic evidence shows that labor market rigidity stifle employment growth and lead to stickiness in the unemployment rate. The easier it is to lay off workers, paradoxically, the more likely employers are to hire them. Because they'll be able to respond more easily to a downturn, employers will be less resistant to hiring staff during the upturn and so better able to take advantage of the good times. It's a situation where everyone gains. The World Bank has constructed indicators measuring labor market flexibility. In New Zealand, for example, there is no cost to an employer for laying someone off, nor is there in the United States. But in Ecuador, for example, it costs 131 weeks of salary to fire someone, and in Sierra Leone, it costs 188 weeks of salary, just to give you one number. It's a similar picture with business red tape. I hardly need to tell this audience that business in today's globalized world is highly mobile. Firms seeking to set up business or expand will gravitate to where the costs are lower and regulation lighter. A strong enterprise culture is a vital ingredient of a dynamic and growing economy. Here in Canada, only two procedures are necessary to start a new business, and it can be done in 3 days. There is zero minimum capital required. Contrast that with Venezuela, where 13 procedures are involved, and it takes 116 days, or Brazil, where the process takes 152 days, or Saudi Arabia, where the minimum capital required is 1,237% of per capita income. Yet in the Netherlands, it takes 48 days to enforce a contract, and it takes 50 days in Japan. It takes more than 1,000 days in Vietnam, and 1,390 days in Italy. In some countries, Indonesia and Malawi, for example, the cost of enforcing a contract is greater on average than the original debt the creditor is seeking to collect. The final challenge is for countries left or falling further behind and is in some ways the most daunting. The Millennium Development Goals, agreed by the United Nations in 2000, have highlighted the extent to which some low-income countries have fallen behind. Experience over the past half century has taught us that ultimately is domestic policy reform that will determine whether these countries that have yet to integrate with the global economy in any meaningful way can begin to share in the benefits of global growth. Without policies that enable these countries to integrate more successfully, their citizens will remain poor and indeed will in some cases become worse rather than better off. Improved governance, reduced corruption, policies aimed at achieving macroeconomic stability are all essential for the sustained growth that will make poverty reduction possible. Without these policy reforms, the scope for help from the international community is restricted. Yet the international community, bilateral and multilateral donors alike, have a vital role to play in helping these countries. Aid transfers continue to be vital, of course. Debt relief has also played a part, and 20 developing countries have now benefited under the IMF's own multilateral debt relief initiative, which came into effect at the beginning of this year. But capacity building, policy advice, and technical assistance are also important, along with aid. Much of the IMF's work in these countries involves assisting the reform process, for example, by enabling them to implement public expenditure management and by improving tax administration. And countries need assistance from the international community if they are to be able to absorb increased aid flows in ways that do not further undermine economic progress. In fact, the IMF has an important role to play across the whole range of reform challenges I've discussed. I noted earlier that the maintenance of international financial stability is our principal mandate, and our main focus is on macroeconomic policy. Those better policies deliver more flexibility and thus stability, and greatly reduce the risk of instability at a global level. More rapidly growing national economies make for more rapid global growth, which was, after all, the objective of the post-war economic framework. But our experience in recent years has taught the policy community as a whole that macro stability depends on a wide range of factors that economists used to think of as microeconomic issues. A sound financial sector, effective and well-functioning institutions, more flexible labor markets, respect for contracts and property rights. These are all important ingredients in establishing macro stability and in laying the foundation for more rapid growth. Failure to pursue reforms in these areas undermines growth and can eventually undermine macro stability as well. So the fund has an important role to play through our surveillance work in highlighting the need for and the benefits from reform. Our surveillance work at the national level through our annual Article 4 consultation with our member countries draws attention to potential policy weaknesses and also notes policy successes. The fund has a unique cross-country perspective, enabling us to understand better what works and what doesn't, and to provide appropriate advice to our members. But we're now moving to greatly strengthen our surveillance work at the global and regional level. Many of the most pressing challenges facing the international economy, the problem of global imbalances, for example, need to be addressed multilaterally. These issues often cut across existing groups of countries and policy fora. The IMF is ideally placed to address these issues. We are, after all, a global institution with a macroeconomic policy mandate. So it was agreed at our spring meetings, held in Washington just about 10 days ago, that we will develop our multilateral surveillance work to enable us to assume this central role in fostering the resolution of international economic problems. We plan to move ahead rapidly with this work. The fund also provides technical assistance to member countries wanting help, specific help with reforms. This now accounts for a significant element of our work and ranges from assistance in improving customs procedures or tax administration to the management of monetary policy as more and more countries recognize both the importance of macroeconomic stability and the role within that of an efficient public sector. Helping countries to improve tax collection procedures, for example, can significantly raise the revenue stream from any given tax rate. Removing exemptions and lowering tax rates can also raise revenues by acting as a disincentive for people to participate in the informal sector of the economy and at the same time reduce distortions and increase efficiency. Streamlining customs procedures can help governments create a more business-friendly environment. And we also provide assistance, importantly, with institution building. Of course, we continue to have an important role in crisis prevention and resolution. The past 15 years have given us plenty of experience of the latter. But the fact that we currently have a very small number of borrowers might suggest that we are now doing a better job at prevention. I would hesitate to be so glib, but our aim is certainly to push for further reforms and further strengthen economic performance in the hope that the world economy will be more resilient when the next downturn comes. So let me conclude. I started by noting the remarkable buoyancy of the global economy at present. Notwithstanding the downside risks, 2006 looks like being another good year of strong growth. The aim now should be prolong the period of expansion. The more rapidly economies grow, the more rapidly living standards of their citizens will rise, and the more progress that can be made with poverty reduction. For many of the IMF's member countries, reducing poverty remains an important priority. Much progress has been made in improving macroeconomic management in the wake of our experience in the 1990s. There has been a worldwide reduction in inflation. Growth has accelerated in many countries. Fiscal and monetary policy reforms have been undertaken, and considerable effort has gone into strengthening financial sectors. But much remains to be done, especially in the area of reducing debt vulnerabilities and in structural reforms, and now is the ideal time to press ahead. The IMF is well placed to help member countries both by encouraging those policymakers tempted to take time out from the reform process and providing appropriate policy and technical advice. This is a time of remarkable success and opportunity for the world economy. We must all do what we can to make the most of it. Thank you.
And in your speech, you seem to say there's a recipe for growth out there. Trade openness, macroeconomic stability, flexible markets, and so on and so forth. Are there any exceptions to that rule? Are there countries that have succeeded in spite of possibly bad economic policies?
There's a question as to your starting point. When China started its economic growth, there were almost no economic incentives in the system at all. And the first thing that was done was to free up somewhat the use of agricultural land, and just some fruits and vegetables. They removed the price ceilings on. Because production was so far below what it could have been, they got a very big response from that, and they got growth. And so what I want to say is if you're starting with a bad enough policy stance, you can get some growth simply by removing some of your worst excesses, and that can go on for a few years. But obviously, to continue growing, there has to be more and more of that done. And the second thing to be said is, fortunately, you don't have to have perfect policies, because otherwise nobody would have done much. But on the other hand, there are degrees and degrees. And I think most people would argue that the countries that have done very well have been the countries that have been pretty single-mindedly committed to getting a good economic allocation of resources and growth, and have put some of the other objectives to the side, at least for the time being.
I've got a couple of questions here related to corruption. What can the IMF do about corruption, or how do you deal with corruption?
Well, again, it depends where it is, what it is, what you know, and what you can do. But there are some obvious things. If you have quantitative restrictions on trade, you've got a lot of customs officers who are going there, you've got a lot of licenses to allocate, and there's lots of profits to be made. Removing the profitability of an activity is a sure way to get rid of the corruption. You can't do it for everything. I mean, there are, after all, construction contracts and so on and so forth. But there are a lot of things where just getting rid of the impediments means that there's no longer a bureaucrat who can block a profitable transaction and therefore collect a payment from. But in other regards, there are lots of things you can do. One of the things we've been focusing on in many emerging market countries is setting up what we call a large taxpayer unit, where they focus on those with high incomes, where obviously there's more scope for greatly profitable evasion, and where indeed getting a more, what I'll call, rational tax structure with lower tax rates, more uniform and across the board, at the same time with enforcement of those, can make a big difference even within tax administration. I could go on and on. There are a lot of things that have been done. Moving away from monopoly state enterprises can make a big difference if you introduce competition into agricultural marketing, for example. Privatization itself can remove corruption in the form of hiring the politicians' nephews and nieces and grandchildren on your payroll. It depends on what the issue is. Some people have tried to make an analytical distinction between what they call grand corruption, where you're bribing the minister or somebody very high up, and petty corruption, where the railway clerk is taking another 15 rupees to take your package sooner. I'm not sure whether that's really valid or not. It's hard to say. But, I mean, there are just a number of things that have worked in different parts of the world, and it is a matter of trial or error. It is not a matter of getting rid of it completely. It is a matter of making sure that at least the most blatant cases do not get publicly known and left absolutely untouched, and so on and so forth. It's a judgment call.
I've got a regional question. What is the likely impact of the wave of populist governments in Latin America on their economic prospects? I think probably they're referring here to Venezuela, Bolivia, and the like.
Well, of course, Venezuela is different because the reason they can do what they're doing is because the oil price is so high. So at the moment, the main problem that they have is that they're blowing the oil revenue that could otherwise be more of a force for good within their country. I'm not sure how big the regional impact will be. Brazil and Chile and Uruguay seem to be following reasonably sensible policies and to be fairly immune from whatever's going on in the Andean countries. The impact on those countries depends very largely on whether the new governments in those countries come to their collective senses before or after too much damage is done. We've had instances in the past where you get a new leader in. I have in mind Alan Garcia, who, incredibly enough, is a candidate to be president again, who came in 1985. Everybody had a party for a year. The national debt ballooned. The prices, inflation got up, I think, to triple digit, but I'm not sure of that. And then they had 3 or 4 years of, minus 20% of GDP negative growth, so at the end of 5 years they were much worse off than they were at the start. That can happen. Bolivia has oil and gas, and depending on how it uses it, that could come out differently. Same for Ecuador. Peru has the minerals. So they all have resources that can be seized, which could carry them for a little while, and it's hard to say what happens after that.
I've got three related questions, really about the role of the IMF and perception of the IMF. One quotes George Shultz saying the IMF should be abolished. The next says, should we challenge the goal of more growth, at least for more developed countries? And the third talks about perceptions of the IMF as a target, as a whipping boy, and the feeling it doesn't benefit lower class or poorer people with its policies.
I think George Shultz's main concern was with the way the financial crises of the 1990s were dealt with. His sense was that the large sums of money that went into those countries had, in some sense, enabled the governments to escape their responsibilities, and at the same time that it had let the banks, believing that the countries would always be, quote, bailed out, would therefore keep on lending to excess. And there's validity to both those arguments, but it is not true that those in the countries paid no penalty. They paid a huge penalty for what happened. I think Korea did the best, and it took them 18 months to get back to pre-crisis levels of GDP. I certainly would not argue that they didn't pay a penalty. On the other hand, I don't like to think of what would have happened in Mexico in 1994 if market forces had been allowed to play out. It's quite clear that they would not have been able to service all their debt, and there would have been difficulties there. But the more important question to me is how would political stability have survived had there been, say, 3 or 4 years of falling living standards, rising unemployment, and all of that? And I think the argument would be that there, on the one hand, you don't want to let the country just go into free fall. On the other hand, you do want there to be adjustment. And the IMF's role is to find out how there can be enough adjustment, and at the same time you can smooth the process at least to some extent so that it does not become politically and otherwise damaging. Second on growth. Well, Canada's rich. The United States is rich. Quite clearly, if there are anti-growth things people want to do, there's no reason why we should worry terribly about it. Some of us might think it was a good thing. Some might think it a bad thing, but it's not critical. In the very poor countries, there are not resources available for other things unless there is growth. Growth is a sine qua non to any other objectives when per capita incomes are $300 and $400 a year. It is not a question of whether we can afford this luxury. They can't. There's no question about it. And the other part of it is that normally most of the things that people want to do require resources, and resources come about more when you have more growth. So I have very little problem with it. I think one could talk, and there are a few cases in world history where there's been growth where the elite have captured all or more than all of the benefits. I have in mind Batista's Cuba in the 1950s, where growth was quite rapid, but where indeed the average living standards were falling, and nothing was done with regard to increasing educational opportunities and that sort of thing. In those kinds of extreme cases, it's quite clear that growth can't last anyway because you need to have more educated labor force and so on as you go forward. So I would have argued that that could not have been good growth even over the longer term. But certainly policies that give people better opportunities for improving their productivity are crucially important for growth. And once you factor that into account, and once you figure out that per capita income is nothing other than the average income, which is equal to the average product of people, the dichotomy does, I think, very largely go away. Okay, people's perceptions that we don't help people. Well, if you have a crisis in Korea or in any other country, there is no choice, but there's going to be some difficulty. The question is only how much. And people say, oh, the IMF came in, they had a program, and people were worse off. Well, in some sense, it's true. But they were worse off relative to what they had been, because what led to the crisis was that people were, and let me use a shorthand, which is unfair, spending beyond their means. If you've got to cut back, you're worse off. The question is, would you have been less or more worse off without the IMF program? And I'm prepared to argue that in the crises of the 1990s, in every case, they would have been worse off without it. You can argue that the programs weren't perfect. One of the things I said was that in capital account crises, there isn't much time. In Korea, to make the case, well, let me go back. In Mexico, in 1982, when they said that they could no longer voluntarily service their debt, they announced it sometime in the first half of August. By December, an IMF program and financial support was announced for Mexico. In Korea, the Koreans said they would not accept the program. They didn't need a program. Everything was fine until on or about December 1st, when they said, oops, we need help. The IMF team got out there and got to work. 2 days later, they got a program 1 hour before gross reserves, not net, gross reserves fell below zero. That's hard to do. And in such a program, with that kind of time pressure, the first time you're going through that kind of stuff, if you really got the perfect program, you ought to be making money on Wall Street or something. But more importantly, actually, in that circumstance, you don't know what's perfect because you're dealing with a probability distribution. And the real question is, how sure do you want to be that the measures you're undertaking will staunch the flow? And if you make a mistake ex post by taking measures that are a little too strong, it's relatively easy to back off. If you make a mistake by not doing enough so the outflow continues, it's going to be much more costly to go ahead. So the ideal program is probably not the one that exactly just narrowly gets it right, but it has some margins of safety that you could then back off from, and that happened, I think, in several of the IMF programs in the 1990s.
I've got a person asking a question and someone else, I think, potentially answering it. The question is, how can we get broader public support for sensible economic policy? There's little support from voters for trade liberalization or for tax and regulatory policies that support growth. And then separately, someone else writes in, globalization fosters a radical increase in information available to governments and individuals. That's somewhat of a spontaneous development, and won't the discipline of the world marketplace allow pro-market policies to continue without macroeconomic tutors? So more information, therefore, will beget the right policy.
Well, think of poor Zimbabwe right now, where the rate of inflation is 900%, where real incomes are falling about 10% a year. The market isn't going to work. No way. The only thing anybody's going to do there until the macro framework gets right is try and get their money out if they can. That's all there is to do. The ability to have a marketplace work depends on a variety of things. It depends on a stable macro framework so that people can depend on relative prices giving them signals and the relative costs can give them signals. It depends on having some kind of a commercial code so that you can enforce a contract. And if two of you sign a contract and there's a disagreement, there's a resolution mechanism. All of these are part of the background, and we keep hearing about markets and how they work. They do work well in an appropriate institutional setting. And one of the problems in many developing countries has been that that setting isn't there, so that some of the trappings of a market happen to be there, and it gives people nice monopoly positions, and it does other things that are very good, but it's not good for the country or for the economy as a whole.
I've got four questions here for different countries. Maybe I'll let you all deal. You can pick. You mentioned the emerging economies of India and China. What do you believe what impact do you believe these economies will have on the future role of the IMF? Will China's bubble economy be sustained? Over to Iceland, recent drastic currency devaluation. How soon do you think how quickly do you think it will take to recover? And then finally, comment on the IMF's inability or unwillingness to bail out Argentina and the subsequent drift in policy framework in that country.
Okay. In India and China, quite clearly both are growing rapidly. With good fortune, they will continue to – good fortune and good policies, they'll continue to do so. And they're taking an increasing share of the world GDP. There's no question about it, and becoming more important as players and as members of the IMF. So I don't think there's anything there that's unusual. We have good relations with both of them, and in fact, the Chinese are using a fair amount of technical assistance, the Indians a little bit, but more as an Article 4 surveillance relationship. As to Iceland, I think already they've come out from the worst of it, and quite clearly you had a financial set of difficulties there, but it looks as if it's already reversing, and it looks like it'll be quite quick in coming around based on what I know. The idea that we could have given Argentina some money and that would have solved the problem is, I think, wishful thinking. Argentina had a number of issues. The reason they got in difficulty was because they, among other things, they had a structure of state or the provincial governments and the federal government. Every provincial government was entitled to borrow money and then use that money to pay its citizens or whatever, and the citizens could use the bonds to pay the federal government. It's printing money by the provinces. Until they corrected that mechanism, it was very hard to see why they wouldn't just get back into the soup immediately. And they have each year done something to keep the lid on, although at the moment the rate of inflation is edging up and there are some questions as to how long this could continue. But the whole problem with Argentina was not that the fund wasn't willing to help. It was that during the period when the Argentines were saying, please give us money, they were saying it because they thought they could do that to some degree instead of some of the adjustments that we judged to be necessary.
Two resource questions. It's been said that when oil reaches $90 a barrel, we will see a serious downturn in the world or at least the North American economy. Your thoughts on this? And how high does gold have to rise before the IMF will call for an orderly return to a gold standard?
The second one is easy. There's no price sufficiently high to do that. As to oil, this is pretty much, but not entirely, an unusual or a different increase in price of oil because it's demand-driven. In past, quote, oil price increases, there's been something on the supply side that has generated a downward shift in supply, and quite clearly, that puts a brake on growth. When it's demand rising more rapidly than supply, which was happening, all that's going to happen is the price of oil rises somewhat, and that curbs demand. It may curb growth a little bit, but that's because growth is high. It's not because we're having the same kind of trouble we had in 1974, 1980. It's just a different phenomenon altogether. For the most part, what seems to be happening is that there are lots of geopolitical uncertainties, and every time there is some mention of Iran, or every time something happens in the Niger Delta, or in Bolivia, or anywhere else, those in the oil market get nervous, and not necessarily without reason. But for the most part, what really looks to be happening is that world growth is very high, demand for oil and oil products is high and growing rapidly. Historically, we've had about at least a 5% gap between actual consumption of oil products and capacity, with capacity greater. As of 2 years ago, that gap was only 2%. And it's so thin now that any concern about any small cutoff in supply then drives up the price because of this very thin gap. So there is a supply element to it. I don't think there's any magic price. I think it's not a question of whether oil goes to 80, 90, or whatever. It's really a question of how much of it goes there because of underlying forces of demand and supply, and how much of it goes either because there's an artificial supply blockage or because one of these geopolitical events happens that changes it in very negative ways.
Last question, really easy one here. Who is your role model, and what advice do you have for a young economist embarking on her career?
I suppose in answer to the first, I can't think of anybody, so I'm going to pass on that one. And young economists, get as good education as you can and get the best graduate training you can, and try also to get some applied experience as well as staying in the Ivory Tower. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more information, please visit our website at www.fraserinstitute.ca.